you everyone for joining us for this webinar. And I've done different events with a lot of you. And what's interesting to me right now is every one of our clients, from the most institutional down to these small family offices, are wondering, what is the future of real estate? And I see every day things getting a little bit more institutionalized, and you know, companies are kind of figuring out, what do we do with our data and what can we do with our data? And so we're kind of at this interesting moment in time where you have acquisitions people who have kind of gut feelings, and then you have data people who are like, yeah, but that's not right because I have all this data, and they're at odds. And so obviously we want to talk about everything, but one of the things that I thought would be interesting is from the human capital management to just talk about what you're seeing as far as bringing on talent that is more technologically savvy. How does that work in the C-suite if the C-suite is more goes on the hunches of things? And would love to kind of dig into what you're seeing, what you're predicting, but maybe we can just go around and everyone could introduce themselves first. I'm Lisa Flicker. I'm partner here at Jackson Lucas in the real estate practice. And Chris and I do everything in executive search and organizational consulting, from small companies through big companies. So I feel like we get a good picture of what's happening in the world of real estate. And then at the end, I'm going to ask you, my kids have both asked me if they should go into real estate. So I'm going to ask for the opinion of everybody on this call when we talk about the future, what you think. Chris, do you want to just...
Oh, sure. Yeah, I'm Chris Papa. You can talk for me, Lisa. It's okay. I don't mind. I'm based in California, and I founded Jackson Lucas in 2017. I've been doing search for real estate since 2004. And yeah, Lisa and I have strictly do real estate, but we also built out a compensation organizational consulting practice. We do a real estate consulting practice too, with clients to help them with their valuations and asset management and things along those lines as well. So, you know, this is top of mind for us, this topic. And we have been working with some clients on data, AI, helping to integrate it with their companies. So I'm happy to have the experts here.
So I'd like to welcome Sabina, who goes by Bina, all the way from England, where it's 10 p.m. Thank you so much for being on and joining us.
That's my pleasure. So I'm Bina. I work for CBRE Investment Management. I'm chief economist, but I also head up what they call the Insights and Intelligence team, which combines fundamental research, quantitative research, and data governance. So it's trying to bring together all the sort of the data-driven insights and deliver those to our clients and our fund managers and CIOs.
Thank you. I'll just go across on my screen. Erin, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure thing. Hi, everyone. I'm Erin Patterson. I am co-head of Manulife Investment Management Real Estate Research and Strategy, co-head of research. And I have been with the organization for about 8 months now. I am based out of my home office in Darien, Connecticut, but I'm in New York today. And I am a co-lead with Victor Kalinog. And so between the two of us, we integrate to have a top-down, bottom-up approach to our research and strategy. And we have a really big emphasis and initiative towards data integration, AI and modeling that we're really looking carefully at in terms of our growth and how to integrate that going forward.
Thank you. Sabrina?
Sure. Hi, everybody. My name is Sabrina Unger, and I am the Managing Director and Head of Research and Strategy at American Realty Advisors. So we are one of the largest completely privately held U.S.-focused investment managers. We invest across asset classes throughout the United States. We, you know, have a few different flagship products. And so what I'm really tasked with and what my team is focused on is sort of a holistic approach to investing in the real estate sector. So combining, you know, macroeconomic forecasting, policy outlook, bringing it all the way down to, you know, competitive set, submarket level, fundamentals, forecasting. And so with that obviously comes a huge focus on data quality, data integration, You know, what are the most efficient and effective ways that we, as sort of a lean team, can operate in this environment? And so it's a sort of a subject that's near and dear to our hearts, certainly.
And last but not least, Umar.
Thanks, Lisa and Chris, for inviting me on this webinar, and glad to be here. Umar Riaz, I run the consulting practice in real estate for EY, based in New York. We sort of do a wide range of consulting in the real estate industry. And the topic that we're discussing today, the data analytics piece has been around and has been top of mind for a lot of real estate companies for the last, I would say, 4 to 5 years or so, because real estate in general has not had the data infrastructure that a lot of other leading industries do. It's largely an Excel-based infrastructure, which has not really supported advanced data analytics. So we've been working with clients over the last 3 to 4 years to modernize the data analytics infrastructure at real estate companies. And now that's all being transformed with generative AI sitting on top. I have yet, in all my years of consulting, encountered a topic that has taken the industry by storm as much as generative AI is. So almost all our, every real estate conference we go to, every conference we host, everyone wants to talk about generative AI, both in the sense of how will it impact the tenant's business and how will that then impact investment strategies within real estate. And second is, how can generative AI be used to improve the performance and productivity of real estate companies? So clearly it's a Lisa and Chris, it's a topic that is near and dear to my heart. We've talked to virtually every large real estate company about this, and glad to be on this webinar with such an esteemed panel.
Thank you, Umar. And you know, each and every one of you are on the cutting edge of what's happening in your companies. So I was also hoping that for people who are listening, who might be just first reaching out to us and saying, hey, we want to hire our first data scientist and we have data, but we don't know what to do with it, that maybe there might be some practical tips on lessons learned and things you've done. But would love to kind of start out by just talking about how you've seen the process of integrating these folks into your team, how you've seen that work, because I'm sure just from the beginning when you hired your first data scientist up till now, you've seen a big evolution and maybe some lessons learned in there if you're feeling spicy. and so I'll go backwards, but we'll end with you, Umar. So I'm going to start with Sabrina.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the challenges, and I'm sure everyone on this call will echo that, is, you know, sort of figuring out how to take the sort of raw output that comes from the data scientists and translate it across to the real estate practitioners, the acquisition investment folks, portfolio management, and doing so in a way that feels accessible to that latter group. I think there can be a hesitation from those on the side of the business that for the last, you know, 20, 30 years, had some data. They weren't making uneducated investments by any means, but they weren't using the sort of cutting edge data tools. And so to forego some of that decision-making power and prowess to the data scientists, there's a little bit of a friction and a hesitation there. And so I think when you're first bringing a data scientist online, especially for a business that hasn't had one, it is about trust building. It is about sort of pulling back the curtain a little bit on process so that people feel there is a sufficient level of transparency such that they can have some conviction in what's coming out of the model. And then having somebody be the champion of that data scientist, it often falls to the head of research, as it should, but to really take what the data scientist is doing and translate it more broadly for the business in a less technical way. I think that's also very critical to have somebody be able to take all the things that are coming out of the data scientist side and really sort of bring it to life. I think that's important. And I think that's where some groups get caught, is they know they have data, they want to be doing more with it. They will sort of put a search out for a data scientist or a data analytics person, and then, you know, sort of stick them in the corner and say, I don't know what they're doing over there. I don't have visibility enough to know if they're doing it right or wrong. And so therefore, you know, I may not put it into practice as well as I should. And so I think that's where some of the friction points come up for the first hire specifically.
And I think over the past 5 or 6 years, each and every client has come to this like aha moment where they're like, we need a bridge. We need someone to bridge from this to that. And it's interesting to see how that's evolving also. Erin, do you want to talk a little bit about your experiences?
Yeah, sure. And I think that's what's fascinating is that it is an evolution, right? So when we talk about data scientists and their role and their purpose and their skill set, ultimately, especially in this smaller world of real estate research and strategy, we're going to need people who understand the business, right? So we're not just talking about a data science, we're talking about a commercial real estate data scientist. And then I think if you take a step back from there, you know, Umar laid it out beautifully where we're talking about building blocks, right? So we're talking about different areas of the business where a data scientist might be valuable, might touch. We're talking about research and strategy. We're talking about asset management. We're talking about acquisitions, the investment process. There's so many pieces. And so for us at Manulife, we are investment managers within real estate, within the body of a behemoth insurance company, right? So as an organization, Manulife is funneling tons of investments to be forward thinking and proactive in terms of data science. So we have a huge data analytics and data scientist team within Manulife. But again, it's that transition to how do we use those skills and that expertise within the real estate space. And so that's what we are exploring now is who is this person that is going to help us leverage the skills and investment that Manulife has already created, born in their data science team. How do we get that to real estate? And so we have actually decided that, yes, we need a person to be able to carry that through to real estate who understands what we're trying to do within real estate and what we can do with that data. Because, you know, what our experience is our Manulife data science team is amazing and robust and highly skilled. And they are also completely overwhelmed and busy with all of the different AI requests and modeling requests from all over the organization that we really need someone that can really take their expertise and run with it in the real estate space. And I think it's, you know, particularly important when we think about leveraging our internal data as well, having someone within our teams that is very familiar with the real estate data that we use on a day-to-day basis and what can be, you know, harvested out of our own portfolios, our own deal process, our own asset management, and be, you know, harvested on an ongoing basis so that we are able to tap into that data and keep the machine propelling, right? And then I think that gets to Omar's, you know, perspective where then that building block is lending to our overall investment strategy. So it's, you know, it's again, building blocks. We're kind of building the ship as we go, not to use too many analogies, but that is the reality in today's world, because, you know, as we said at the beginning, when we were chit-chatting, you know, a lot of these jobs in AI, they didn't exist even a year ago. And so what we think about going forward a year from now, 18 months from now, we're going to see the same thing where we're going to start seeing new vacancies that pop up. Oh, we didn't even think of that, especially in terms of governance and process management. You know, we're going to need a lot of new and different jobs to accommodate all of that.
Great. Bina, tell us what you're seeing.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's maybe two different approaches, isn't there? You can have a centralized pool of data scientists that you hire explicitly as such, and they might be sitting central to multi-asset. They may be even offshore doing sort of commodity data science, building dashboards, coding. And we certainly have that capability as well. But I think we've taken a slightly different approach, which is not necessarily to kind of budget as going out and hiring data scientists. We've always hired researchers and quants and performance analysts, and now they have a different set of skills than when I would have been hired 20 years ago when people had a bit of an econometrics and some urban geography. Now they all have to code. So I think it's just the core skill set in the job that's changed. So I've never really, I suddenly thought to myself, have I ever hired a data scientist? And I was like, well, probably not, but everyone has that now. And I think it's gone hand in hand with upskilling the existing team. So I never wanted to feel like there were a bunch of people we hired 10 years ago who were great writers and geographers who are suddenly being switched out for data scientists. So we've done a lot of bespoke training to get people fluent in Power BI and Python and R. And partly this, I mean, my team is 60 people globally, so we have the scale to do that, which is phenomenal. And then also upskilling the business. So this idea of a bridge person or a translator from the data nerds through to the real life people who are making real estate decisions. I think the way our US CIO puts it really beautifully, Julie Ingersoll, is what having Excel was in the 1990s is what being able to code is now. So anyone we hire as a financial analyst or an asset manager should have a basic knowledge of what's going on. This is going to be table stakes. So we want to make sure that we're designing all our processes so that the fund managers, the CIO down to sort of junior analyst, everyone feels they have a connection to how we're putting data out and how we're manipulating it and feels confidence in it. So I think if it's sequestered and put somewhere separate, it will feel more frightening and it'll feel harder to understand. And frankly, people will fear for their jobs. We've got to upskill the entire workforce to make sure they have confidence in their future and the processes that we're putting in place. So that's the approach we've taken, which again, it may be specific to our scale as much as anything else.
Thank you. And Umar, I guess you get to see this across a lot of large companies, yeah, and maybe some mid-sized companies. Would love to hear what you're seeing in the battlefield.
When I talk about data scientists and data analytics, I think too often people migrate to sort of checking the box and saying that they have a data scientist on staff or a team of data scientists on staff. And then they come to us in, two, 3 years and say, well, I'm not getting the value out of it that I wanted, right? I think the key here is that the companies who are very successful at it start with data analytics from a business perspective, saying, what do you want to use it for? What kind of decisions, what kind of analytics are you going to drive with this capability? And then that should drive your decision to hire or not a data scientist. And then I think the definition of what a data scientist is pretty broad also, right? Some people will interpret it as purely a technical job, which I think is the wrong thing to do. It's not someone who can just purely code or write code or integrate or pull data, right? It's just to Bina's point, that the job of a data center as a scientist right now has become a lot more all-encompassing. So it's someone who knows the industry, because you need to have someone, as was mentioned before, with real estate expertise, someone who knows the industry, someone who can identify business problems themselves. And the third is people who do have technical capability. So it's a tough position in terms of to get it right. But I think the first step in getting it right is defining your data strategy to say, where are you going to use this in your business and what kind of decisions are you going to drive with this? And that flows through what the capability you need. And that drives the success of a successful data scientist organization, data science organization.
What data are you, what's the most important data in real estate investing right now? Like, what are you looking for? Where are you getting that from?
I think with real estate investing, it is tough to say that there is one data source, which I think that the team here can probably talk to it better than I can, right? But the way I see it, right, it's both a plethora of both external and internal data. Some of it can be related to real estate, some of it cannot be, because in some ways, right, when you're projecting the future and future investment decisions, you're trying to project consumer trends and business trends, which then translate into real estate trends. So I think the data that you get is that's sort of the magic here, is the data that you're going to use to drive investment decisions is terribly complex in some ways. And to then take all that data and drive meaningful decisions out of it is what I think the three people on the call here with me do day in and day out. So maybe they can talk to it better. But what I see is that, and that's when we talk about generative AI, for an example, that's an area where everyone wants to use generative AI to gain a competitive advantage for making investment decisions. But what people are finding in the beginning of it is to set the algorithms and to set the data needs out there are actually is very complex, because suddenly the kind of data you can access is a lot more than you had before. So then to drive meaningful insights out of it becomes challenging. I don't know if Bina and all you guys would agree with that.
Yeah.
Well, I think.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, just to take a step back quickly too, if we think about just how our definition of real estate has changed over time, you know, it used to be if you build it, they'll come, right? So it was very pretty black and white. You build something, it's occupied, and the data around that could be very measurable, right? And then if we think about where we are today in this real estate world, Umar, to your point, there's a plethora of data out there. And I think what's most nuanced is that today, when we think about how real estate is used, it's very much based on human behavior and human capital trends, right? Which is a lot harder to quantify as well. At the same time, AI and advancements in technology have allowed us to gain insight into those behavioral trends. But still, the history of data is not quite there as it would have been the way we would traditionally measure real estate performance. So I think, you know, it's a combination of understanding what types of data points that we need now to educate the investment decision. And we think about the purpose of real estate today. It's not as much about the built environment. I mean, we're looking at new alternative or artists formerly known as niche, as I like to say. When we think about, you know, industrial outdoor storage, we're just talking about land. But still, that is becoming real estate. And if we look at tomorrow, what is real estate? Is it, you know, virtual space? Is it the metaverse? You know, how, what is real estate's real definition going forward? And that changes the way that we use the data, how we look at data, what data points we need. And the other piece too is, you know, real estate data has never been like a Bloomberg. It's not real time, but now more than ever, we do have that ability to tap into real time data. And so all of this is happening at once, which is wonderful. It's a confluence of many, many great events in technology and innovation. But at the same time, we don't necessarily have the platform built to harness that data in the right way. So it's important that you are thinking about this very carefully as you integrate these data pieces into your research and into your investment strategy, and know how to govern around them too.
Yeah, and I would encourage people to think about it. I mean, if you're starting from scratch, then you shouldn't be thinking about this as a research and strategy tool. You should be thinking about corporate strategy. Mm-hmm. And building a data lake and putting all your data in it. I mean, I think all the commonly used pieces of data that we all buy in were already pretty easy to interrogate because you would have had them delivered on Refinitiv or Bloomberg or whatever. What this enables you to do is very powerfully look at the data that you're producing. I mean, we own $150 billion of real estate. So we're producing an awful lot of data about how people are sort of coming through our real estate and the costs they're in. And I think the big revolution in my 20 years of doing this is not so much on the investment side, because actually I think we had a really good handle on the data around the investment side, but it's the asset management side and really now getting amazing real-time information on, and it couldn't come at a better time, right? Because CapEx is higher. We're all having to sort of recreate the built environment while we're in it to tackle sustainability and a whole host of other behavioral issues. So to me, it's using the proprietary data. And I would say that don't even get to generative AI and how you're going to interrogate it until you spend a good few years sorting out your data governance, your data quality, and where it sits and where it's housed. There is years of like really unglamorous, boring data work before you get to the cool playtime with whatever your lockdown version of AI is that you're going to use on top of it. Because otherwise you're just going to spin your wheels. The real advantage used to be in real estate, if you had scale, because we're an asymmetric information business, the bigger players had more information. I do wonder if generative AI competes that away a little bit, but I think where the scale might help is just that and the upfront investment in cleaning up your proprietary data. So that's where I would start if I was starting from scratch.
Are you guys seeing, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but maybe this is for Umar across the board, but where people, because I have a lot of companies that say, We don't know what is valuable about our data, but we don't want to put it into some kind of a public place where everybody has access to it. Nobody knows why, but they know that they shouldn't be. And so I'm wondering if people are seeing like proprietary versions of AI made by individual organizations so that when you put your stuff in there, it's not being shared across the industry.
Well, let me first state very unequivocally that you should not be sharing your own company data in any public forum. So let's be quite unequivocal about that. And absolutely right. There's more than enough technology available, whether it's proprietary data platforms or it's generative AI, which you can get enterprise licenses for. You don't have to use ChatGPT. You can use your own version of it. Absolutely, you should be keeping your data private. And I would echo what, you know, that two of the points that Beena made, right, is, you know, we talk a lot about sort of the, you know, these new advanced analytics driving investment decisions. But I think in the short term, what's going to be more compelling is how they drive asset management decisions. You know, areas such as how to maximize rent, how to maximize occupancy, how to do more, efficient potential tenant due diligence and all. I think there's going to be a lot more applications in asset management. And then investment decisions, I think, is going to be an art form that's going to evolve over time. And the other very important point that Beena made is that even if you want to use these tools, the first thing you need to do is to get your data analytics infrastructure right. Because there's no way that you'll be effectively be able to use generative AI or these advanced technologies or even advanced data analytics without having a robust data analytics infrastructure. So regardless of whether you're dabbling with generative AI or not, regardless of whether you are, putting in machine learning and all, first and foremost, get your data right. Because, in real estate, we have a lot of data silos where, the data resides in different systems and the connective tissue is Excel, which I think is not a very robust long-term strategy for having a data analytics platform.
Yeah, and I think to Beena's point, it takes so much longer than people anticipate or appreciate to clean up that data, right? We, when we're all sort of subscribing to the same third-party data, that's no longer a differentiator. So it is the proprietary insights from your own portfolio that are going to be the differentiator. And, there's human error involved with where that data comes from and how it gets put into these separate systems. And so making sure that it's clean and validated and then can translate and talk to each other through these systems takes so much longer, I think, than people that are sort of starting out in the process appreciate. And it takes a strong partnership with your IT departments and them also understanding the real estate business, I think, is critical.
I spoke with someone who was an intern last summer, and their whole job was to go through a company's data and make sure if it said if it was January 7th, it was 1/7 and not 7/1, because they were trying to put together trends for the seasons, and they were finding that through the years they denoted it different ways. So like just something silly like that could throw you off.
That sounds awful.
It does sound awful.
Start somewhere. Yeah, but I mean, the good news is once you've done it, there are ways to lock down your sort of your AI. We have one at CBRE called, unsurprisingly, LS.AI. And it's lovely because at that point, you can start training it. And then my advice is just let the youngsters in your team have at it once it is a safe environment and where you have low value, commodity, repetitive tasks. Start training those models. And it's phenomenal. Like you can go through your process and sort of predefine what you think will be the easy wins to pick away at, but I'm daily amazed at what my team come up with of new things to do that's better and brighter, because their creativity and agility has been unleashed by doing. So I think a little bit of courage and fortitude. And what I would say to anyone senior on this call or doing this is, rather than sort of scare people that maybe their work's gonna be competed away first, we all have a low value add task. Why not try and automate your own first? And then show to your team that it's not a threat, you're doing it too, and you're freeing up this time to do something far more exciting with the time that you've released. But I'm daily amazed at what they come up with that we wouldn't have even thought of a year ago when unleashed on these tools.
And then the other point, Beena, that you made was, and I get asked that quite frequently, is what are the advantages of scale? So can only big companies afford to invest in this? And what I'm actually finding is that big companies have a much more difficult task ahead, because the more complex your company is, the more disaggregated your current state of data is, probably.
Yeah, harder to turn a cruise ship than a yacht.
Exactly. The more silos you've built, and if you're a smaller company, it's actually your data is more well-defined. You don't have as many silos. And the good thing is that the investment required to create these capabilities is quite achievable now. It used to be that if you're building advanced data analytics capabilities, you know, 5-10 years ago or so, it would have been a fairly significant investment. I mean, right now in the current environment with all cloud-based tools that you can use and all, it's not an insignificant investment, but I think even for smaller real estate companies, highly accessible. So I don't think you should let that scare you off that only sort of large, more sophisticated organizations are the ones who could put in the infrastructure. In fact, you know, scale might have a disadvantage in terms of overall change management and the one-time change required to get everything in the right order. I don't know if you guys would agree.
Yeah, I think, I mean, we're seeing it on our side. I would say relative to my peer set here, we're a smaller player, and being able to be nimble and the data, you know, it is a smaller denominator, firstly. So that certainly helps with the transition and, you know, having key people and there not being multiple silos within the business that weren't talking to each other for the 30 years that we've been in business, I think has really lent itself to us sort of adapting quickly and building out some of the low-hanging fruit that Bina's talking about. What are the repetitive tasks that we're all spending time doing that, you know, can be automated, that are not terribly value add? Let's free up our team's time so that we can be doing more higher impact, you know, asset management specifically today. That's been a huge area of growth for us. And I think because of our size, we've been able to move pretty quickly. So I agree with your comments, Umar.
And I think what's been mentioned by a couple of you is also that differentiator, right? When we all have access potentially to very similar third-party data resources, how do we really set ourselves apart from each other and remain competitive? And I think, you know, there is a struggle bringing up the change management piece is getting more senior leaders on board as well with integrating this fresh new data. You know, we have, you know, tried and true third-party resources that we've gone to for years and years and years. And now we're all of a sudden trying to harness our internal data, which is the way to go to differentiate ourselves. But again, how do we not only, you know, manage the security of the data and, you know, do the scrubbing, make sure that we have accuracy and consistency in the way we're tracking. But then, you know, again, the change management piece, how do we get our senior leadership on board with accepting this data and accepting the way that we're using it to be proactive and strategic in our management strategies? And so one of the pieces that we're really thinking about when we're building out our modeling and our data science capabilities within the research space is integrating with our third-party providers, right? Understanding what, you know, what initiatives they have in place to utilize generative AI, what they're doing with their modeling to incorporate more advanced thinking, more advanced data modeling, and how can we sort of leverage their, you know, their work with ours so that their data is still relevant and we can still call upon that in support of our own findings out of our internal data. So I think that's a big piece for us. And just knowing that, you know, at the end of the day, these third-party data providers also have their thumb on the pulse of changes in what's going on with data too. So when we think about, you know, one of the big things that we're grappling with at NCREIF is the reassignment of geographies, how, you know, the MSA coding and CBSA coding has been changed. How do we negotiate that within the NCREIF space? And then, oh, all of a sudden it's something we have to think about in our own data science, you know, and building the modeling that we're doing now. So it is great to have, you know, as careful as we have to be about our own company data, it is nice to have those open source conversations too with our third-party providers.
Yeah, I think that the senior leadership change management piece is interesting. And I think maybe one of the, by complete luck rather than judgment, pieces of fortune that we had is we've always had quite a sizable listed unit, and they made a big change from being, you know, always very activist investment managers, but they changed to a very sort of quant-driven model around 8 years ago. And in fact, the guy who now leads our firm's quant team was a PM in the listed. So he was a pure portfolio manager, went back to university, retrained in statistics and coding, and came back to kind of manage that transition into a more quant-driven listed strategy. And then has brought his skills to the wider platform. So we've always had this integration. So this kind of, because we had to do it with this one smaller business unit that we had within the 150, I think that helped and we saw the success, the investment performance that came from that, I think it helped sell it at the broad level. Then I think the other thing that maybe helped us is I was kind of like smiling a little bit, Erin, when you said in the old days, you know, we had like normal sectors and we had data. Because when I started in 2008, we were investing in China and Poland, and I'd come from a UK background where we had like, in the UK, we literally have real estate cap rate data back to 1920. And then you get to China and you have like 6 months and who knows, right? So I think we've always had to be quite inventive with our own proprietary data coming from our on the ground people, because we just didn't have the luxury of time. So forecasting was always really interesting for us. And I think that has led, thankfully, our PMs and CIOs and senior people to always be a little bit imaginative and out of the box on data, because they've been sailing in kind of uncharted waters and they knew that it's probably our data or no one, right? Because you don't go by someone off the shelf to tell you what's going on in sort of like the third ring of Shanghai in 2006. So I think that's just good fortune. And I do wonder how it works in other companies where maybe it's much more of a senior level sell. I feel like I'm lucky because that door's always open.
Yeah, that change management is really important. Sabrina, you were going to say something.
Yeah, I was going to say that for us, I think being able to demonstrate the small wins builds big momentum with senior leadership, right? I heard this expression and I've heard it described in AI and it really stuck with me, which is it is not a system where it's data in, miracles out. And I think managing and calibrating those expectations,
right,
that we're not going to dump in our data, third-party data, and that it's going to give us the magic silver bullet of investing where we're going to make a win every single time. I think calibrating the expectations up front is critically important with sort of change management going up the chain. But, you know, the other part of it is demonstrating those small wins and the sort of return on time, return on minor investment it takes to make those small wins. I think it gets senior leadership excited to see what else can we do? What can we do that moves the needle a little more? And so often, you know, I think somebody mentioned it, but identifying what is the low-hanging fruit that you can execute with these sort of data programs and AI and generative AI first, getting the buy-in from the win there, and then starting to see the snowball get bigger as you go. I think that's critical if you're in an organization where there may be some hesitancy at the top to really adopt a data forward thinking strategy.
You know, I was explaining to them that they've, you know, everyone's always used data. We make every decision based on data, right? It just may be different data now, right? And so it just reminds me of, I'm a big baseball fan, and like I used to read all these baseball data books back in the 80s and 90s, and it was very revolutionary at the time, and you're like a baseball nerd, and then all of a sudden it started getting adopted more and more, and then they would hire, you know, the most important person they would hire was started being like the guy from Harvard that knew data analytics and like made all the decisions, and like all the old guys and you know who were like running the team were like, oh, I don't want it. So they started hiring, instead of hiring these old guys to be the managers, they would hire the young guys who could explain to the players why we're making these decisions. Kind of like you guys said, you need like someone who can come in and make, you know, explain to the investment people why these decisions are being made. And then not a
money balling real estate. That's what we need to tell
right.
them.
And so that's what it feels like here. But now there's getting like, so it's about like looking at like what data is important. Because we used to look in baseball, like batting average. And then you look at actually what batting average made it of, and like, it really means nothing. It's very arbitrary. So they started looking at other data, and like, so it was like explaining to people, oh, they've always looked at data. You're just looking at the wrong data to actually get what you want, which is a win, right? And so is that something you've had to come in, like create new acronyms and like make it easy for people to understand, right? All these things. You can't have really long acronyms or like, you know, big explanations. It's just like, here's the stuff we're looking at and why we're looking at it.
I'd say that's the task of research in general, right? Is taking all of these very complex things and systems and frameworks and forecasts that we make and translating it into the accessible at sort of any knowledge point. And all of our senior leader teams are, you know, very well versed in our asset class, have been around for 20, 30 plus years. And so they are experts in their field. And so it's less, at least from our perspective, less about sort of telling them you need to use data, and more about, you know, how do we on the research side make it accessible and usable, I think is even more important, because you know, we can get into the very technical aspects and sort of nerd out on how we're forecasting and all the different factors that go into that. And, you know, for these people that have very, you know, sort of short windows of time, that's all great. I, you know, hired you and trust you to build that out. So tell us what we do about it, right? And so I think that's what we're all tasked with here.
Yeah, I think the key that I always say to my team, it's the so what, right? You know, we can step back and we can pick apart the data. It's really, well, what does this mean for the portfolio? What are the action items here? What can we actually use this data to educate in our strategy and make it real? And I think once you figure out messaging that so what, it also creates a feedback loop of knowledge, right? Because then our team, our portfolio managers, our asset managers, our acquisitions team, they're hearing that message and they're going out there into the world, they're doing their jobs, and they're also picking up data along the way. And now they have a language in their head that they're listening for, and they can come back to us and say, hey, we have these data points, or we heard about this. And then again, it feeds into our day-to-day work. So it is really about creating that feedback loop that, you know, is oiled very well and starts to churn out information internally that really drives the investment strategy forward, especially, you know, as today, you know, the areas again that we're investing in today look very different than they did 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and that's going to continue to evolve. So if we have our team going out there, feet on the ground, thinking about what data points that we're looking for across the board, that's where we really do start to pick up those new pieces that educate our real estate research and strategy perspective in these new areas of investment too, that, you know, to Bina's point, don't have that long history either that we struggle against.
And then we also have to recognize that there is aspects of creativity and all within real estate and vision in real estate, which probably will always be needed, right? So if you look at sort of asset management, those decisions should obviously be made as quantitatively as possible, based on, you know, advanced data analytics. If you're doing sort of, you know, transactions in the industry, whether you're on the buy side or the sell side, that should also be very quantitatively driven, right? But there's one aspect of this industry, which is new development, which requires creativity. So that kind of, you know, activity can be supported by data analytics, but still there's an aspect of vision and creativity and imagination that's tough to replicate. So I think we do have to acknowledge that there are aspects of the industry which absolutely, right, and they might be quantified maybe, you know, 50 years from now when robots have taken over the world. But in the current environment, there is the intuition and creativity that a lot of the leading edge real estate companies are still is extremely valuable in aspects of the business.
And like I say, I kind of feel these tools are unleashing creativity. I think actually, you know, I mean, I've forbidden Excel on my team for a while, but for people who are still prisoners of Excel and prisoners of the low value add repetitive work, actually it's a prison. It's a prison of thought. And I think what these tools do, they free up your time, but they also free up the possibilities, because now rather than your preconceived notions of what kind of 3-4 data variables might have driven this outcome, you can try and run factor analysis over 1,000, over 10,000, right? So it's quite liberating. And I think that when I'm hiring people, of course, like it's table stakes now to be a coder, but I also want, and I'll use the two words again, creativity and agility. And so when I'm looking at the CVs and the kind of the skill set, it's not necessarily STEM. I'm looking at people who really are good and holistic and think in a quirky, interesting way, because you can't kind of future-proof by hiring what's going to be useful for this moment, because we're just living in this world of incredibly rapid change.
And you know, in the area of Gen AI, right, it's that the competitive advantage is not going to come from the data you can access, but clearly you have to have the data in the right place. It's going to come from what questions are you asking?
Exactly.
So where is the creativity? So how can you embed more creative questions, which has been asked to your point, right, is that if you're hiring people, the creativity becomes really important, because the, you know, the day-to-day work clearly is important and needs to be done. But the magic is going to happen with asking creative questions.
Indeed.
Thanks. Well, I'm just going to We'll end with a quick question and then open it up for some Q&A to the audience. But I'd love to hear if anybody had any, like, wow moments as you've kind of been going through. So I had a client, I was in their office recently, and they brought me to their data room. And then they showed me how they had these drones on all of their development sites that were able to not only, like, you could view what was happening on the sites, but then at the end of the day, somehow it was like creating this like spreadsheet of data that showed, like, okay, this is 50% complete, this is 30% complete. Oh, and by the way, there's a leak in the west roof. And it just, I'd love to hear that and you know, any predictions or thoughts for the future, because I feel like you guys are all in the seats where you're probably going to see it first.
I'll go first.
If you have any.
I recently
a surprise question and a hard one, so I'm sorry.
Very chivalrous, Ma.
I can tell you, right? I recently had visited a client, which is a developer and operator of real estate, and it's a relatively small company, right? It's $5 billion of AUM, and in the grand scheme of things, they're not small, but you know, based on the people on the call here, they would be considered small. And I was blown away by the data analytics infrastructure that this company had built. And a lot of it was the vision from the CEO. He was extremely motivated by embedding data analytics into his company. And all throughout the life cycle, right, asset management, development, and all that, they have sort of incredibly rich data on where to put future developments in their asset class and how to maximize rent and occupancy. And I was just blown away by the fact that this company, right, which is not on any of our radars, had built such a sophisticated infrastructure. And now that the bigger funds are actually coming to them, trying to build in similar capabilities. But this goes to the point, right? The bigger funds are having issues because they just can't be as agile as the smaller company has been. So, I mean, this goes to the point was, you know, you don't have to have scale to have the capabilities and the vision and the infrastructure to do successful data analytics.
Yeah, I'd say for us, a project that to me just really sort of proved our base case for why we want to continue to lean into this and was sort of exciting is the idea of bringing together sentiment data. So sentiment data scraped for specific assets in our competitive set, and then bringing that in with the sort of off-the-shelf third-party fundamentals data, and then triangulating across our own internal views to sort of come up with leading indicators of forecasts for fundamentals, because, you know, especially in the current environment, you know, we really are focused on, you know, the ability to drive, you know, NOI growth, and what are the assets that are going to allow us to do that, and what does sentiment that we can scrape from all of these places on the web that are sort of non-traditional real estate data, what can that tell us, and what can that tell us about making smarter investment decisions or electing not to invest in specific assets and or understanding where we sit in our competitive set. So it's something that's, you know, relatively low hanging fruit. And, you know, we're not a massive organization, but putting a little extra effort into that is really yielding us some very interesting insights. And I think we're just scraping the surface of that. So I'm excited about that piece.
Yeah, I think my aha moment was recently looking at some cold storage facilities and really delving into that deeply and understanding what level of data analytics and AI these companies are using, the management companies of these cold storage facilities, the grocers, the behemoth grocers who are able to vertically integrate cold storage into their strategy. And just taking a step back and saying, wow, you know, if cold storage is becoming part of our portfolio, again, this is a whole world of data that we've never contended with before, that we've never housed before. How are we going to go about taking in this data and making use out of it? Because the reality is the data that we can get from these cold storage operating partners is not just relevant to cold storage, but it provides great insight into human behavior, which then lends into how do we think about our retail strategy? How do we think about demographic patterns and consumption and so on and so forth? So that was the real aha moment where if you don't have the platform and the programming to accept this data and receive it and make use out of it, you're going to be behind from day one.
Yeah, completely agree. Here's a prediction for you. I think the most valuable skill set in 10 years, well, maybe even quicker, will not at all be coding. It'll be the probably like old school classics in humanities, the ability to think across subjects, and people who do multi-combination, multivariate humanities degrees will actually be the best prompt engineers. They'll be the best people at dealing in this world. So I don't know, like, what do you tell your kids to learn right now? 10 years ago, it was coding. I don't think it's that anymore, right? Is it? So that's my prediction, that there's been a huge revolution in the makeup of my team. I think 10 years ago, it was probably half people with econometric backgrounds. Now it's half people with data science backgrounds. I think in the future, even that will change again. So try and keep an eye on the future. When data is democratized, it's how you're going to be looking for interesting connections and articulating those in a truly unique and authentic voice that doesn't sound like someone just spat it out of an AI. That's going to be the real differentiator, is how you communicate in a way that is unique and memorable when everyone is suddenly articulate, but in a rather bland manner.
I'm the poster child. I went to grad school for English, and I found that it has served
me.
Maybe,
Sabrina. I want you and a Latin grad, like, to get, that's what I want. That's really what I want. Bring me people who learn classics and I'll take them.
It's a real skill set, right? Like, being able to translate the data is critically important, and you need people with those technical skills, but being able to communicate it, and to your point, authentically and in a way that excites people and makes a call to action, whether it's internally with our investment professionals or with our investors and LP capital, having a voice that resounds with those people and makes it real and tangible and exciting, I think is going to also be a differentiator. I think it is today, and I think it's going to become more so.
Well, Bina, I'm glad to hear that, because my daughter is majoring in classics and going
to real estate. My way, Amar. Seriously, I'm hiring.
She is interning for real estate investments next semester.
It's knowledge that was good 3,000 years ago and it'll be good in 3,000 years. I think it's the only thing we can count on right now.
You feel you mentioned the democratization. Well, everyone's trying to keep their data like secret, right? Like, they don't want anyone else to know what it is, basically, I feel. But eventually, at some point, I feel it's going to get out there, and all the public's going to know. And real estate's traditionally publicly traded real estate is pretty, it's exclusive class can invest in this stuff. It's very, you have to know somebody who knows somebody. Do you think eventually those walls are going to be kind of taken down by all this data, and it's just going to trade more like fluidly, as opposed to like kind of the secret clubs?
I mean, there have certainly been attempts at it already, right? You're seeing the retailization, tokenization of private assets that historically were in the institutional realm. There, I wouldn't say limited success, but limited, sort of chipping away at our market so far. And I do think, absent something materially changing, the regulatory onus on groups to maintain, their data internally and make sure that it doesn't leak out, I think there's such an emphasis on that right now, and that may slow down what you're alluding to, Chris, which is sort of a true democratization of the private class through all of this proprietary data that we all have. I think that's a limitation.
And there's a limit to how far it can go, right? Because at the end of the day, every property is unique in its characteristics. So it's never going to be quite as transparent and liquid as fixed income. But I think it can go a lot further. And I think it will serve. I mean, someone's asked a question about what's the greatest threat all of this poses to our industry. I don't really think it's a threat, but a lot of people are going to be disintermediated, because our industry has lived on very fat profits from asymmetric information and sort of, who you know and how you get your data. And some of those kind of rather low value add advantages, which were just hoarding data, will be competed away. So we're going to have to be smarter and earn our dollars in a slightly different manner. But I don't really see it as a threat. I see it as a raising of the game. And frankly, if the industry becomes more transparent, more liquid, more easily tradable, more accessible to the retail investor, that is only to the good of real assets generally, right? So I don't think it's a threat, but I think it is a radical change. And I've been in this industry now since the year 2000. I think this is the most radical change I'm seeing, but I think it's a good change, and it's been a long time coming.
Certainly fascinating to watch.
Yeah.
We have one question. Do you see it, Lisa? We have one question from the audience. Do you see it? Do you want me to ask it?
Go ahead, ask it.
What is the biggest threat that generative AI poses to our industry?
Look, I think real estate is a physical asset, right? So there are industries out there who are going to be significantly disintermediated by generative AI. So when you think of the technology industry itself, when you think of media and entertainment, these industries, the structure of these industries is likely to change significantly over, say, pick a time frame in the next 5 to 10 years or so, right? Real estate is an industry where we, you know, regardless of what happens with generative AI, people still need physical spaces to inhabit, right? Whether it's to live, to work, to play. Now, the sort of disruption potentially that could happen in real estate is what asset classes become more or less attractive with generative AI. I think that's where the disruption might happen. Just like with digital transformation, the retail asset class clearly suffered a lot and changed quite a bit as a result of what happened with digital commerce. I think generative AI will also probably lead to some shift in attractiveness of particular asset classes. But I think largely this technology is going to be the good to the good for the industry. To a lot of the points that Sabina made in terms of how we can harness this technology, both to make better asset management and investment decisions, is all to the good, to create a more liquid market, to create more sort of, you know, opportunities for people to invest in this industry. All this is very positive. But the industry as a whole, I think, should look at this technology and embrace it as a potential for great productivity and return kind of capabilities versus a threat.
Well, thank you, everyone. This is one of my favorite topics. I feel like we could talk about this all night long. But since it's now 11 p.m. where Pina is, I think we end it and maybe come back for more sometime. But thank you so much, everyone, for participating. This has been phenomenal.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. Bye, everyone. Bye.